You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1994 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Ian Finley on the subject, Put on Beautiful Garments, O Jerusalem.
So we left off yesterday, we quoted from Isaiah 7:14, where it speaks of the Lord Himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Now to us, this is a very, very key verse, and you wonder how anybody could possibly deflect this or interpret it incorrectly, particularly when we look to Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. Those of you who aren't familiar with this, it'd be a good time to look it up. Matthew 1, verse 23 quotes, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which being interpreted is God with us. So here is one case of a prophecy in the Old Testament being spelled out verbatim in the New. That's good enough for us. Unfortunately, it isn't good enough for the Israelis, when you're discussing it with them. This has been reinterpreted by the rabbis, the great rabbis, as they call them, to mean other than the Son of God. Now, pressing on, in 722 B.C., we take ourselves down to Sargon II, who eventually overcame Samaria, and he was, incidentally, for those history buffs, Sargon was Tiglath-Pileser's successor, and many thousands of Israelites were exiled to Upper Mesopotamia and Media. The northern kingdom, composed of the 10 tribes, was destroyed, and its people banished, and Judah alone was preserved, with Jerusalem now as the sole national capital. Is that in focus? It isn't too good anyway, but how is that better? Worse. Okay. Thanks. Jerusalem was considered the center of the world. On this 16th century German map, you see that it's the crosshairs of three continents, Europa, Asia, and Africa. And this is the landmass through which the traffic passed back and forth between these continents. And it's interesting that even then it was considered the center of the earth. In our main events in the history of Jerusalem, we're now down to about 715 to 687, in around this area here. Assyria to the north was now a deadly menace. It was right on the borders of Judah and Jerusalem. Isaiah and King Hezekiah were prominent in that era. And Hezekiah, he is the king in the south, he strengthens the physical aspects of Jerusalem. And in 2 Chronicles, we won't look this up, 2 Chronicles 29 and 3, we read that he opened and repaired the doors of the house of the Lord. And we will turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 29, for this quote, 2 Chronicles 32 and 30. This same Hezekiah also stopped the upper water course of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works. Now I think I can show this to you with our famous little map. There is I keep standing on my plug here. There's the topographical area. Now, you've all got a pretty good idea now how Jerusalem, the present-day Jerusalem, is up here. And this is a little bit south of the Dome of the Rock. This is very fascinating, and I know, I'm pretty sure some in this room have gone through this tunnel, which starts here at the Gihon Spring, outside the walls. And Hezekiah plugged up this cave, and he had a water course channeled underground through here and across here into a lower pool and then further on down to the pool of Siloam. And this, I think, is about 600 yards long, as I recall. So, step one, Hezekiah sealed the Gihon cave in which the spring issued. He sealed it off so that the invaders coming at the city would not have access to water. And he cut a 600-yard tunnel leading the water under the southeastern part of the city out to a reservoir pool inside the city at a point where the ground is lower, which is the Pool of Siloam, which can be seen, of course, to this day. Now, in 1880, this was all confirmed, complete, with a Hebrew inscription on how the tunnel was excavated. Two teams of miners started at opposite ends, and you'd like to say that they met dead on. Well, they didn't quite do it. It's not that terrific, but it is quite a feat for the tools that he had available to them. Now, in the next verse, though, we see another aspect of Hezekiah, verse 31. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart. And if you'll keep your finger there, we'll refer to 2 Kings 20 and verse 13. 2 Kings 20, verse 13. And Hezekiah hearkened unto them and showed them all the house of his precious things, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious ointment, and all the house of his armor, and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house, nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not. Now this was a dangerous, foolish, and perhaps a proud thing to do. And he, like we do, when we make errors in judgment, generally end up paying for it one way or another. And we find that Isaiah, later on, we won't look this up, Isaiah chapter 17, warns that the days will come that all that is in thine house shall be carried into Babylon, and nothing will be left. All right, here's our timeline back up again. And in 710, in around here, in 710 B.C., they were besieged by Sennacherib in the north. And Hezekiah resisted that invasion. And Assyria retreated because word had spread somehow or other, that Jerusalem was inviolate. So they backed off. And we find a little later in 610 that King Josiah, king of Judah, got in Pharaoh Necho's way, who was coming up from the south. Remember the old battles between the north and the south? And they clashed at Megiddo as he marched toward Assyria. And he was killed, and he was dethroned and carted off. And Jehoahaz, Josiah's son, was set up, and followed by Jehoiakim. I think that's, you probably can't see it. That's on right in here, I believe it is. Jehoiakim succeeded his brother. In 606, in around this area here, the first invasion by Nebuchadnezzar occurred, and the captivity begins to last, as we know, 70 years. And this is referred to in Jeremiah 25, and we won't look that up either at this point in time. We'll put this chronological background up again for a moment. And we're in this area here, 589 to 587, when we see the final invasion by Nebuchadnezzar resulting in the 2 years siege of Jerusalem, which is recorded in 2 Kings 25 and 2 Chronicles 36. And the Babylonians, we read, built a siege wall to starve them out. But they left momentarily to deal with Egypt, again another threat from the south. But then they returned after this threat was put down, and they resumed the blockade against Jerusalem. In 587, the walls were breached, and the battering rams were put into play to beat down the walls. King Zedekiah fled. He was captured in the plains of Jericho, and as we know, he was brought before Nebuchadnezzar, and he saw his son slain, and then his eyes were put out. And he was carried off in chains to Babylon. And we have a Martin Gilbert depiction here of the dispersal of the Jews in 587. And I'll read this little box here, in case you can't see it. Driven from Jerusalem by a succession of conquerors, the Jews sought refuge in distant regions, where they settled and formed compact and often prosperous communities. But however far they were from Jerusalem, they remembered her in their prayers. A month after the fall, Nebuchadnezzar sent orders to level Jerusalem. He burnt the house of the Lord, and some of the surviving prominent citizens were deported. Daniel, of course, and others that accompanied him are the well-known ones. From then, through the centuries, the Jewish lament, which we read in Psalm 137, applied, where they say, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." In 538, putting this chart back up, the numbers I quote won't always correspond with here, because various historians disagree by a few years here or there. But 538, Babylon fell at the hands of Cyrus. Cyrus, we know, was a wise and enlightened ruler touched by God, and he offered cultural autonomy to his subjects, respecting and giving protection to their creeds and customs. And Israel was certainly a beneficiary of that. In 536, Cyrus issued his famous decree favoring restoration of the Jewish commonwealth and religion in their own land. And we could perhaps put this on the screen for a moment. Jerusalem lay in ruins from the effects of the Babylonian era. The temple site was charred rubble. The political climate suddenly changes in Israel's favor, and they are allowed to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. At first, the work of restoration is tackled with vigor and enthusiasm. Then, in the face of cunning opposition by their enemies round about, which is a recurrent phrase which I'd like to deal with before the week is out, God willing, their zeal and faith in the project begins to wane. Zechariah comes on the scene to revitalize and encourage them with prophetic visions of greater days ahead for Israel and Jerusalem. Jerusalem remains the focus throughout the prophecy. Ahead lay dark days of subjugation by many enemies. But early in the prophecy, Zechariah promised, "The Lord shall choose Jerusalem again." The prophecy culminates in a portrayal of Jerusalem triumphant over her enemies round about, and a returned and glorified Lord in command. Great changes in Jerusalem's topography are described in preparation for its role as capital of the world and site of the temple to which all nations will flow. Now the return was organized under Sheshbazzar, and this, whose name was Zerubbabel, and this we read of in Ezra chapters 1 and 3. And putting up our chronological background again, picking it up around 535 in the second month, the foundations of the house were laid. 535 to 520, the Samaritan opposition. The work ceases until completion of the 70 years captivity from the final invasion of B.C. 587. In 529, Cyrus died, succeeded by Cambyses, his son, then Smerdis and Darius Hystaspes. In 520, the second year of Darius, of which Haggai writes in the sixth month, and Zechariah writes prophetically of in the eighth month of his reign, Darius supports the renewed work. In 519, in the 11th month, Zechariah received his first seven visions, which are recorded in Zechariah chapters 1 through 6, which we won't look up now. In 518, a deputation from Bethel on the eve of completion, 70 years from the destruction of the temple. And in 516, the temple was completed and the dedication celebrated, which we read of in Ezra 6 and 15. Teddy Kollek writes of this temple that it was as large, but not as ornate as the first, as Solomon's temple. And the Jews still consider both the first temple, according to Teddy Kollek. For the next 70 years, the history of Jerusalem is somewhat obscure from a historian's standpoint. The Jews of Babylon had become well established as scholars and men of commerce, businessmen, etc., high officials of the Persian regime. And if we'll turn to Nehemiah chapter 1, we'll get just a bit of a flavor of the time. Nehemiah 1, verse 3, And they said unto me, The remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. In 465, Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes and grandson of Darius the First, is on the scene. In 445, a delegation from Jerusalem, headed by Hanani, reported on Jerusalem's plight to Nehemiah. And in Nehemiah, the next chapter, chapter 2, verses 13 to 15, we see the inspection tour. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then went I up in the night by the brook, and this is the brook Kidron that we are often referring to, and viewed the wall, and turned back, and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I went or what I did. The kingdoms bordering on Judah tried to hinder the work of the restoration, as you know, through their own personal antagonism towards the Jews and their own personal agendas. And Nehemiah made two formations to combat this situation. One, to maintain defense, and two would continue on with the work of rebuilding. And both groups were armed. And it's very reminiscent of the early days of this present state of Israel in the early 40s when they were on the kibbutz and they were plowing the fields with their tractors, and yet they had a rifle over their shoulder, even the women and the children in the various kibbutzim. Nehemiah is a good source of the book Nehemiah is a good source of life in Jerusalem at the time. And here's a depiction showing the work of rebuilding the walls in Nehemiah's time. And the walls of Jerusalem again included, south to north, the Pool of Siloam, which we referred to, or the stream of Gihon fed to, the City of David, Ophel, and the Temple Mount. And there were eight gates, which we won't go into at this point in time. I'll just throw this on the screen to give you a bit of a flavor. The dotted line represents the city as it once was. This is why we can't get too excited about the present city walls, because the walls have been changed periodically through history. And at that time, Nehemiah's time, this was the outer wall, and there was a total of eight gates at that time, strangely enough, too. And in Nehemiah chapter 8, at verse 1, we read of the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot, as they refer to it. And this is, it says, all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the street that was before the water gate, and they spake unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded to Israel. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both of men and women, and all that could hear with understanding upon the first day of the seventh month. And down in verse 17, it says, the latter part of the verse, they sat under the booths. For since the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, unto that day had not the children of Israel done so, and there was very great gladness. And as those of you who have been to Israel know, to this day the Feast of Sukkot is a very great event. They make little booths on their back patio. Even the big hotels in the courtyard will make booths of olive pine, myrtle, and palm branches, and you live under there for that particular week. And then the eighth day is the final festival of celebration. And it dates back. Sorry, they put them on not over top of their roofs, but they just cover an area like a patio or a balcony, and they live under there. It harks back, of course, to the days of when they came out of the Egypt, and they came upon that area with the pond, and they made booths to preserve the people in the desert sun. Ezra got permission from the Persian monarch to lead a great company of priests and Levites to Jerusalem to re-instruct the Jews in Torah. And I didn't bring it with me, but Teddy Kollek has an excellent page in his book on the power of Torah to preserve a people. And those of you who have been subscribers to Leslie Johnson's Letter from Jerusalem, he used to emphasize that we shouldn't knock the Jew or the Israeli for his observation of Torah, because it is keeping his mind fixed on the Almighty and his purpose with man, albeit darkly. They don't see it clearly. But it is a powerful instrument, and has been for centuries all over the world in every culture, to keep Jews from being assimilated. If without it, they would be like many other cultures that have disappeared. They're no longer with us. So Torah has been a very, very powerful instrument. The Torah merely means the law of Moses, or the word of Scripture. Now, we're into the Hellenistic period, which we can see here, 332 to 167. The next 100 years prior to 332 There's almost no written records of Jerusalem until Alexander the Great, or Alexander the Greek, if you will, conquered Persia. And Alexander, you know, died at 32 in 323 A.D. Alexander left Jerusalem largely untouched, and there's conflicting stories as to why. Some of them are very romanticized, but basically his generals quarreled about the efficacy of capturing Jerusalem, and therefore they didn't bother with it. And then we come on the situation we have here. The Seleucid kingdom in the north and the Ptolemaic kingdom in the south. You know, you have your usual north-south setup that is throughout Scripture. And the center, of course, of the Ptolemaic part would be Alexandria in Egypt, and the Seleucus would be Syria, or Antioch and Seleucia in the north. And as always, here's good old Judah caught in the middle like a sandwich, and always under stress and duress. Ptolemy won the first fracas, and for the next 100 years, the Jerusalem was under the Ptolemaic dynasty. And he deported Jews, which began the large Jewish colony in Alexandria, Egypt. And that, of course, had some great benefits. Because under Ptolemy II, the Bible was translated into Greek at Alexandria by the 70 scholars recruited from Jerusalem for the purpose. And that gave birth to the Septuagint, which most of us have had access to or benefited from through the years. In 167, we read of the Maccabees. You've probably all heard of the Maccabees. The Seleucids, under Antiochus III, routed the Ptolemaic Egyptian army, annexing Palestine, and Jerusalem was now under the Greeks of Syria, the Seleucids of the north. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, imposed the Greek way of life, including the worship of Greek gods, on conquered peoples, including Judah. And some Jews, as we know, responded favorably to Hellenism. But the temple in Jerusalem, was to be called Olympian Zeus. And Greek troops slaughtered swine to the heathen gods on the altar. This was the ultimate insult, you might say, to any vestige of faith left in Jewish worshipers. And the practice of Torah and the practice and the observation of their feasts became punishable by death. In 167, the Jews struck back at the oppressors, liberating and cleansing Jerusalem of their armies. And I think I've got this a map of the modest success they had. My source for a lot of this information about the Maccabees was from Colic and Perlman, who naturally were looking for every piece of evidence to show how tough the Jews were in resisting the opposing hand of the enemy. And we read the following. The action which sparked the revolt occurred in the village of Modin. And I believe this is somewhere near the airport over here. Yeah, here we are. Modin. And the airport, Ben-Gurion Airport, today is just right about here. So at Modin, Mattathias of the house of Hasmon had 5 sons, Johanan, Simon, Judah, Eleazar, and Jonathan. And Antiochus officers rode into this town of Modin and announced a public worship of a pagan god by the sacrifice of swine's flesh. Mattathias and his sons were called upon to submit, and thereby be honored with gifts, etc. When a Jew stepped forward to comply with this edict, Mattathias slew him and a Grecian. Then they fled to the mountains and were joined by others called the Hasidim. That's, we hear of the Hasidic peoples. Well, this was the Hasidim, the same people. It's a Hebrew word for pious. And they operated as guerrillas against the Seleucid troops, swooping down on the pagan altars that had been set up around the land. Mattathias died, and Judah, nicknamed Maccabee, or the Hammer, carried on. And the dynasty they founded is called the Hasmonean, after Hasmon, the great-grandfather of Mattathias. And they had some success against the Seleucids, conquering the temple site, and they cleansed it of Zeus worship. And the temple was rededicated on that famous day I was referring to last night, on the 9th, was it December the 9th? Right. 3 years to the day after the temple had been desecrated. To this day, Jews throughout the world celebrate the Feast of Hanukkah for 8 days in around our Christmas time, as you know. The legend goes that when they went onto the Temple Mount, they found only enough oil in the lamp, in the menorah in the temple for 1 day. But they lit it anyway, and it burned for 8 days miraculously. So that's why to this day they have the 8-day festival of Hanukkah. So for the next 23 years, the Jews faced the Greeks right on the Temple Mount there, just a few meters apart. And the Greeks were set up in their fort of Acre while the Jews were operating around down below them. Later, under more benevolent rulers, the Jews were allowed to acquire the whole of Jerusalem. In 63 BC, the Romans under Pompey took Jerusalem, bringing the Hasmonean dynasty to an end, except for brief periods of resurgence. Now we're down to the Herod the Great period, which leads us up to Jesus' time. 37 to 4 B.C. Antipater, his name means the manipulator, who was the he was the father of Herod. Anyway, this Herod was a descendant of the despised Ishmael and the hated Esau. And he greatly aided the Romans in suppressing the Hasmoneans. And Herod was appointed governor of Galilee. In 37 BC, the Romans under Mark Antony made Herod king of Judea. Herod, according to historians, was a cruel, cunning, savage, explosive man. He even murdered his wife, Marianne, as well as others. But he was the man who built Masada, which I'm sure most of you know about, that resort in the Dead Sea area. It was a retreat for him during the certain months of the year, and that was the place which the Jews retreated to, which we'll get to later. And it's used to this day to dedicate for the graduation ceremonies of the Israeli Tank Corps. They go up there, and on a torchlight parade, they vow, never again will they submit as they did to the Romans at Masada. Anyway, he had this fetish for building, and he built Caesarea. He built a palace in Jerusalem. He built another palace to the southeast of Jerusalem out in the Judean desert. He built towers and walls and gates. He was a great builder. And some structures in the southwest hill give rise to the tradition that this was the ancient stronghold of David. But most modern scholars agree that the city of David lay in the southeast, as we have been showing you, south of the present temple site. But the greatest of all was his building of the temple. And this work began in 20 BC. I hope you can see that fairly well. That's the work of our brother. That's Len Rittmeyer's. In fact, his name's on here somewhere, isn't it? It is on my copy. Brother Len Rittmeyer, as I was telling you last night, those who were here, he is an archaeological artist and works with most archaeological teams in Israel. And he's called upon, for example, very good example, this is Robinson's Arch here. And this was always thought to go across, similar to this one, across the Turopian Valley, which runs down here. And this is the Valley of Hinnom. And this is the Kidron Valley. And this is the Mount of Olives. This arch, just a little bit left today, was thought to go right across. But I believe it was Len Rittmeyer, subject to correction, and another gentleman, who figured out that that it might not do that. It might have a different way that was originally built. And sure enough, when excavations were done here, they found entrance steps where people came up the Turopian Valley and went up this way and into the temple site in this direction. Now, this was a great breakthrough archaeologically. But anyway, this sheet here, which has been in Biblical Archaeology Review, there's also a nice section in a book, Harper's Bible Atlas, which is an amazing work that many Christadelphians up in Canada have. Len Rittmeyer is the major contributor and artist in that book as well. I'll just read you some comments. No mountain in the world has such a unique and fascinating history as that of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Since, however, Herod's building was merely a reconstruction of that built after the return from Babylon, it retained the name of Second Temple. The Muslim authorities under whose jurisdiction the Temple Mount lies today do not permit archaeological investigation on the Mount itself. Therefore, this reconstruction drawing is of necessity more concerned with the area around the Temple Mount. The Western Wall, is not, contrary to tradition, a remnant of the Solomonic Temple, but a small section of Herod's massive retaining walls, which he built to support the enormous quantities of rubble needed to build up the temple platform. To the left of the praying area, we see what is known as Wilson's Arch. Let me see where that is. Here's Wilson's Arch right here. That's there today, or a good chunk of it is. And I'll just try to highlight this thing for you, which spanned the Turopian Valley, as we see. The next element we examine is Robinson's Arch, which is this one here, which is the site next to the entrance to the south. And one of the most spectacular discoveries of the dig. It had generally been assumed to have been the first of a series of arches which formed a causeway spanning the valley in the same style as Wilson's. Josephus writes that the last gate led to the other city where the road descended down into the valley, as we see here, by a great number of steps and thence up again by the ascent. And sure enough, when they excavated, this is what they found. The many features of the southern wall, this is the southern wall along here. I'll try to point them out if I can for you. The double gates are here. They're there today, so are these. They're filled in. And these are the triple gates. The monumental stairway, which is right here, and the plaza this area here, which probably served as a meeting place for the pilgrims, it says. And there's bathhouses out here for the ritual purification before the entering into the temple. And this is the royal stoa, this long structure here, the royal stoa or porch, which ran the entire length of the southern wall, 280 meters. And the eastern wall, of course, is the one that has always been, as Sully concludes, on the line of construction for the future. The location of the eastern gate is as yet undetermined. The only visible entranceway, the Golden Gate, in fact, dates from the early Islamic period. At the northeast corner, the Herodian Tower 20 still stands to a considerable height. And that's the one that where the Stork Tower now stands in the present city. And that's, other than the Western Wall, which I referred to, that's about the main points of interest in this structure. They began the work in 20 BC, and it was finished only a few years before AD 70, before the destruction. Herod, his heart alien to Judaic interest, built to appease the Jews. He even trained 1,000 priests as masons and carpenters to work on those parts of the sanctuary which profane hands were not allowed to touch. And we just noted that the temple was classed as a reconstruction. The ground plan and the interior arrangements of the temple proper, the house of worship itself, were exactly the same as before. These could not be altered. They were fixed by the Bible. But Herod increased its height and vastly amplified its porch and set it all on a series of descending terraces with courts, as we see here, colonnaded and walled. The temple was of large blocks of white stone, its facade plated with gold. Herod built a platform 400 by 300 yards. That's what this area is. It's a huge, huge area, supported by substructures and great buttress walls rising from the ravines that bounded the Temple Mount. The Wailing Wall, or the West Wall as they more commonly refer to it now, revered by the Jews, is one. And then we'll probably end here with 4 years before Christ, Herod's gory death. He died a dissolute man, and even his associates thought it was the wrath of God upon this evil man. I think we'll stop there. There's another point I want to make tomorrow. Thank you.